in most parts of Indonesia. Let's see, I've already talked about Islamic Renaissance, right? So anyway, maybe I'll skip ahead a little here. So I was looking for a number of things with my questionnaire. We did in-depth interviews. My wife, Arsiana, who's an anthropologist, went with me. And so I had excellent, I had an assistant more skilled than I was. And so we traveled around Indonesia, passed out questionnaires, interviewed people, and we got 2,492 questionnaires back. From all different religious groups, all different ethnic groups, and we were looking at particularly one of the things we were looking at that I deal with in the book. I couldn't deal with all the. I got a lot of interesting data from these questionnaires, and I've tried to analyze them statistically, but there was far too much to fit into this book, especially since I wanted this book to be readable and interesting to a wide audience and not just to Indonesianists. So anyway, but one of the things I was looking for was, do Indonesians inhabit a sacred cosmos? And is Islamic modernism, especially Muhammadiyah movement, in the process, since it is trying to purify Islam and get rid of superstition and polytheism and animistic practices and syncretism and reestablish a pure, rational Islam. It actually sounds a lot like the Protestant Reformation. Is this just like the Protestant Reformation was one of the vehicles of secularization and disenchantment? So is Islamic modernism also having this impact? Well, I posited four characteristics of a sacred cosmos. You'll have to read the book to get all the details, but the four characteristics of a sacred cosmos is that, first of all, individuals are embedded in communities. The basic unit of Western society is the individual. And the basic fundamental unit of Indonesian society, all over Indonesia, is the family. This is a big overgeneralization, but at the same time, it really affects the way people imagine what is real. In particular, the community is not limited just to the living. The family is not just the living family. The family includes the powers that surround us in the forests, in the mountains, in the ocean. Most people in the city I live in, Yogyakarta, believe that Ratu Kidul is real. Nyai Ratu Kidul is the queen of the South Sea. And she is a powerful goddess in Indonesian mythology. Now, Muslims have reinterpreted her to be a jinn, since jinns are in the Quran. So she's the head of the jinns of the ocean. Just like Mbak Merapi is a jinn, if you need a label that fits with your religion, that lives up on the mountain Merapi. But people from all different religions believe in Grandfather Merapi and the Queen of the South Sea as real beings who have an impact on our life. The community is not just the living people. The community is our ancestors and the powers that surround us. This is actually a picture of the ancestors of one of my students. They're called Tao Tao, and they have they're carved representations of the ancestors. Secondly, communities are embedded in nature. Nature has agency. We are surrounded with powers, and I've already talked about that. It was interesting to me, a couple years ago I was at Yale, and there was a seminar on the agency of nature in resisting colonialism. And the speaker gave a very interesting paper in which he was arguing that the mosquitoes that brought malaria were somehow resisting colonialism. I thought it was an interesting kind of attempt to use mythological language with what was essentially a non-mythological explanation. But still, in Indonesia, there is almost all ethnic groups have multiple rituals that are intended to keep the balance with nature around them. I remember my shock when I was in Bali not long after the Bali bombs in 2004, was it? In any case, the Bali bombs, maybe it was 2000, and anyway, whenever it was, I was struck by the contrast with the reaction to the Bali terrorist bombing in contrast with the reaction in America to 9/11. Because the people I was talking to in Bali, they were saying, I mean, this is overgeneralization, but what they were saying to me was, we have gotten out of balance. We are not in balance as a society. There is too much materialism. There is too much destruction of nature around us. And this bombing is somehow a judgment on us. It's karma. If you're Hindu, as they are in Bali, it's karma that this is punishment of us from not being in balance with nature and with the environment around us in Bali. Thirdly, nature is embedded in a moral order. It's not an impersonal universe, but rather a cosmos. A cosmos that has moral law, and Muslims can give you lots of theology to justify this. It has a moral law that governs not only human society, but also nature. My first experience of this was when I had only been in Indonesia a few years, and I was honored to be invited by a friend to a birthday party for Romo Mangun Wijaya, who was a leading Catholic intellectual architect. I won't go into details about him, but anyway, this birthday party for Romo Mangun was attended by a number of leading intellectuals in Indonesia, including Abdurrahman Wahid, the Gus Dur, who later became president. And we were sitting around the dinner talking about what was the meaning of the eruption of Mount Merapi, this mountain. It had just erupted, and they were all talking about what does it mean. And I'm thinking, tectonic plates? Yeah. And they're saying, this eruption means that Suharto is about to fall. And I thought that I had stepped back into a Shakespearean play where the spheres, the music of the spheres, are somehow in tune with human society. But they were very serious about it, that this eruption was a sign. Not that the eruption was going to cause Suharto to fall, but that it was a sign that Suharto was going to fall. Because nature is also part of a moral order. And the human society is part of the same moral order. So what happens in nature can be a sign from God or from the ancestors or whatever, from the powers that surround us, of things, the meaning of things that happen in human society. They also said that Gus Dur was Samar. Some of you know Samar. Samar was the most popular figure in Javanese mythology and legends in the Ramayana and the Mahabharata stories. He's a Javanese creation, and he's a fat, short, ugly clown who speaks in very low Javanese, is always telling inappropriate jokes and making inappropriate noises. And he's a lowly servant and a joker. He's like a joker in Shakespeare. But anyway, they're saying Gusdur, who also happens to be short and fat and ugly and very funny, like Samar, they're saying Gusdur is Samar. Well, I don't know what to make of all this, and I would not presume to make anything of it, but within 1 year, actually within a few months of this meeting together, Suharto had fallen from power, had been deposed by a people power movement, and Gusdur had become president. So their prediction that night was right, even though I don't know exactly why. Fourthly, the moral order is embedded in God or the transcendent power that is over all of us. This is the first principle of the national ideology, that there is one great power, one great deity over all of us. We may have different ideas of the transcendent. We may be Buddhists or Hindus or Muslims or Christians. We may be different kinds of Muslims, but there's one God over all of us. And that leads to the second principle of the national ideology. There's one humanity. We are all one humanity. This is a picture that I used on the cover, got permission to use on the cover of my book, because I think it expresses something of the way Indonesians believe that this moral order that nature is a part of is embedded in God. Now, of course, not all Indonesians live in a so-called sacred cosmos. In fact, there is a just as wide, I don't even know if more do than in America. A lot of Americans who are into various forms of transcendentalism or Pentecostal religion or other forms of belief have a belief in powers that surround them. But I think that the Indonesian, do I have an arrow? I do. Okay. Indonesians can be represented by three of these people. The first one, in the middle with the arrow on him, I was talking with him, and he's a Catholic priest with a PhD from Rome, and he said he doesn't believe any of it. Doesn't believe in spirits, he doesn't believe in powers, he doesn't believe in miracles, he doesn't believe in dreams, he doesn't believe in... He said, all of that is incompatible with modern science and with modern rationality. We need to leave that stuff behind. I asked him if he still practices the kind of cosmic rituals that the people use in his area, and he said, of course. He said, it's functional. It's useful. And the people would be very disappointed if I didn't do these kind of rituals. But he doesn't believe there's any real powers that are behind it. Right next to him is this guy, another priest, also with a PhD from Rome, or whatever they give in Rome, some kind of doctorate. And he believes all of it. He believes in spirits, he believes in dreams, he believes in meaning, in natural disasters, he believes in powers that, you know, when I was pulling out of the place, somebody was telling me that there was a spirit that lived in the parking lot. Sometimes they couldn't back out because the spirit would stop them. He believes in all of it. For him, a sacred cosmos is an existential living reality that he experiences every day. The third guy was the rector, the president of the institution, and maybe because he's politically astute, he took a middle position. But I would say he's in the position of second naivete. He said, well, maybe it's true, and maybe it's not. He sort of believed, but was also skeptical. And I would say that most of the students I have believe some things and don't believe others. They don't all agree on what is true and what is real. They have a wide range of wide variety of beliefs, but most of them do not have what Taylor calls a buffered self. Most of them believe that there is communication from God or from spirits or from the ancestors, from angels, from other kinds of supernatural beings, from people from beyond who can communicate with them from time to time when they need it. I'm almost done. So where is Indonesia heading? And where is the world heading? I love the pictures. I have a lot of pictures of these Balinese dancers because I think they wonderfully unite some modern idioms like the white face and so on, and movements and ideas, avant-garde ideas, with Balinese cultural forms and Hindu symbols in a way that's really quite wonderful and amazing. And of course, Balinese music. Nobody knows where the world is heading, and where Indonesia, as I said, where Indonesia is heading will depend not just on Indonesians, but on what happens in other parts of the world. Humans use multiple ways for understanding and making sense of reality. And these include mimetic rituals, myths, ethics, and science. We do not know things in only one way. The four axial civilizations that lay the foundation for the modern world, China, India, the Middle East, and Greece, are all deeply a part of Indonesia. But Indonesia is not, it has interacted with these axial civilizations for many centuries, perhaps thousands of years in some cases, but Indonesia has not been annexed by any of them. It's not part of the Sinosphere. It's not part of the India sphere. It's not part of the Middle East. And it's not part of Europe, even though the Dutch wished it would be for a while when they called it the Dutch East Indies. But it has retained its own character. And it is creating a kind of modernity that is unique and I think has something to teach the world. We have a lot of crises facing us. These include domination of Western theoretic modes of thought. Scientific truth is the only truth. My mentor, Bob Bella, my wife and I talked with him for a couple of hours just I think 2 weeks before he tragically died, and in the conversation he was very pessimistic. He felt that Western theoretic modes of thought were leading almost inevitably to human annihilation, to human extinction, because of the way we are destroying our planet at such an unprecedented rate. I'm not quite as pessimistic as that, but I think there is a problem here. There is the religious reaction of dogmatism, polarization, conflict, and violence between religious groups. We saw in Indonesia development projects, educational projects, wonderful work that had been done for many decades just be destroyed in a few hours when religious groups came into conflict. In fact, my wife wrote her dissertation on conflict in the Moluccas. The renewal of ethnic chauvinism, fascism, exclusivism, and the environmental crises which are destroying the earth. I think we need all four modes of knowledge, of cognition, to address these crises, not just one. We need science, obviously. We need to understand global warming. We also need better stories. We need good symbols. We need rituals, ways in which we imitate what is true and right. And I think Indonesians have a lot to teach the world. The last point, number 7, is a quote from Tony Reed. Indonesians have much to teach the world about the civilized and dynamic coexistence of multiple worldviews, both in ourselves and in complex societies. We are not linear creatures. We need linear thinking and critical analytic thinking, but also other ways of addressing the problems that we face. So this is a kind of bird's eye view of this book. I hope some of you may read it. If any of you want to write a review of it, I will have Yale send you a free copy to review it. So just let me know, and they're happy to send a review copy if any of you would like to review it. But I have a couple of copies here. If anybody wants to buy a copy, I'm happy to part with some now, and I'm told that that's allowed. So, questions.
We have time for questions.
Yeah.
Could you just identify yourself?
I'm Bob Shepard from Seeker Center. Is this kind of purification project working? If that's sort of the big thing you started with, to what extent is this having inroads? Do you get any sense from your data that if it is, or?
My sense from my data and also from talking to people is that it's not working. I don't have any base for, in terms of disenchantment, for example. I don't have research from 20 years ago that I can compare now with then, or let alone 100 years ago. I suspect that probably belief in the unseen world was stronger among 20 years ago, but some of my colleagues that are not all that positive about it, who are critical of enchantment of a sacred cosmos, are they think it's getting worse, if you can put it as worse. They think there's more beliefs in spirits and powers and so on than there used to be. So the book is an attempt to be a descriptive analysis rather than a normative analysis. So I'm not trying to say what's right or wrong or what's good or evil, although there's one chapter in which I try to honestly and openly deal with the question of magic and the supernatural and what is truth and what kinds of truth there are in it or not and so on. So just as there's every kind of Christian under the sun, so there's every kind of Muslim under the sun, and there's a lot of differences. So, but my sense, you know, I have one chapter that is interviews with 6 Muslim leaders in Indonesia, 2 from NU, 2 from Muhammadiyah, and 2 who are independent, nationalist, if you like. All of them have PhDs, and all of them are prominent leaders in Indonesia. And they break all the stereotypes. One of the Muhammadiyah leaders is first naivete, thoroughly believes, no question, surrounded by powers. And the other Muhammadiyah leader believes the powers are there, but believes we shouldn't have anything to do with them, that they're not an existential part of his experience. Of the 2 NU leaders, one of them is a complete secularist or disenchanted person. He's NU, but he doesn't believe in spirits, but he's all in favor of all the rituals and stuff. He thinks he's really against attempts to curtail that. He says it's They are functionally very valuable. They are stories. They are like Christmas for Western secular people. It's fine for people to believe in those things, even though he doesn't. But the other Anu person is sure that we're surrounded by all kinds of powers. Then the two independents, one of them is the head of a Panchaksilat, martial arts school that is steeped in mysticism, and she doesn't believe in the spirits. She says they should practice. They should practice their martial arts rather than, you know, pray in graveyards trying to find extra powers or something. But the other one, who's an expert on religion and science and very oriented to understanding science, he says we are, it's not a matter of disenchantment or enchantment, it's re-enchantment. And he believes that there is that we are meaning seeking creatures, and that we need to believe in these powers around us, and he thinks they're real. He says that when he looks at a mountain of garbage, he can feel the bad energy, and when he looks at a beautiful scene of the ocean, he can feel the positive power that's there. So he's got a different way of talking about what is enchanted or disenchanted, and so on. But I think. Like one of the six leaders was Shafi'i Ma'arif, and who used to be the head of Mohammedia, and he thinks that belief in all the spirits and all that, it's becoming, he doesn't think it's dangerous, he thinks it's okay, but he thinks that it's getting stronger in Indonesia. Unlike some Mohammedia, he doesn't think we should have anything to do with them, but he thinks they're real.
Okay.
Yeah.
Deepa, a lot of belief from Siva Center. What you are laying out sort of seems to go against the grain of what you tend to hear about the rise of official Islam, which when you put it next to everyday practices, of course, in many contexts you see the disconnect. But to what extent do you see the official Islam, for lack of a better word, trying to constrain these practices because it doesn't fit into their worldview? Or are they sort of exercising a certain self-restraint, understanding that Indonesia is not Saudi Arabia, as you well point out?
Yeah. It's undeniable. This is the apple in front of the person's face. It's undeniable that Islamic piety, conservative piety, expressions of official Islam, public rituals, and so on are booming in Indonesia. It's when I first moved to Indonesia, almost no women wore the head covering, and now almost all do. Not all Muslims do, but there's a lot of, if you don't wear a head covering in Indonesia now, it's a statement. If you're a Muslim and you don't wear a head covering, and some of my colleagues don't, and it's a statement. But so the social pressure to conform to Islamic modes of dress and to pray to solat five times a day, and so on. It's really hard to know whether this official pressure, well, it's not official, it's unofficial pressure from certain groups, whether this is dominant or not. I have one colleague who's the dean of the College of Letters and Science at Gajah Mada University, and she's a Muslim, and she says, the people like me, we are the vast majority. But we're too lazy to resist, you know, let them say, we'll have our time when we will be able to express ourselves. But the great majority of the people, or not the great majority, but a substantial majority of Muslims in Yogyakarta are